My name is Julie Pearson Little Thunder. Today is Thursday, May 7th, 2015, and I'm interviewing Juanita Patapony for the Oklahoma Native Artist Project, sponsored by the Oklahoma Oral History Research Program at Oklahoma State University. We're in Lawton at Juanita's house. Juanita, you're an artist perhaps best known for your mixed media works. You're also an educator, an activist, a writer, and even the subject of a documentary film. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Portland, Oregon, although I know nothing of Portland, Oregon. And I grew up just up the hill from here, my house. And it was lovingly called the Comanche Yellow Mission. And it was an Indian community that surrounded the what's now called the Comanche Reformed Church area. But at the time that I grew up, it was a little Comanche community, and didn't know anybody else was, happened to be another tribe. But we did have some people that were Kiowa, and I learned later, and Caddo. So we did have some mixed marriages there.
And your folks had already moved back from Portland when you were an infant, I guess.
Yes.
What did they do for?
Well, it's a long, convoluted history.
Okay. What did they do for a living? What did your mom and dad do for
my,
a living?
My mom worked at the Indian Health Service. She was, early on, she was a seamstress. And it was during the times when doctor's coats needed mending or something had to be autoclaved. I always remember that word, had to be autoclaved, which meant that it had to be sterilized, and so she did some of, get things ready for that. She did a lot of, but she wore a blue uniform, and when I was a young girl, I thought she was a blue nurse. I didn't know, but, and she thought that was pretty funny. But my father worked for the Department of Interior. He was soil and moisture conservation technician, and again, just right up the hill when it was located there. Actually on the same road. My mother worked across the highway on I-44 at the IHS Indian Hospital.
Wow. How about siblings?
I grew up as an only child with my parents, Sam and Marjorie Patapony. And my mother was a Quanah Parker descendant. My father was, and she was from the Quahada band. My father was from the Benetuka, our honey eaters, wasp-stinging band of Comanche.
How about your relationship with your grandparents on either side?
On my dad's side, I grew up, they were very mysterious to me. They were Peyote people. And at least his father was. Now, I never met my dad's mother, our grandmother. I never met her because she was gone before I came on the scene, but she was very Christian, and she was a original member of the Comanche Reformed Church, which was in those days called the Dutch Reformed Church. And it was one of the missionary movements in the started out as a missionary movements when the Comanche were divided up among several missionaries. Some were Baptists, some were Dutch Reformed, some were Methodist, some, very few, I think, Catholic.
And on your mom's side?
On my mom's side, my mom was a Quanah Parker descendant, and the Quahada people. She came from a big, large family in Walters, Oklahoma. And I just have good memories of uncles and aunties and the stories and a lot of teasing and, just a big family. In fact, my mother, her family didn't want her to marry my father because there was only one other person, his brother, Howard. And they thought that was just too weird. So they were used to a big family, and they were very suspicious of my father being in such a tiny family.
So, and you were around the language quite a bit.
I was around the language because my mother and father were fluent speakers, and I would hear them talking, but they stopped whenever I came around, and but they still used some particular words, and they taught me a little thing like animal names, and I heard some things over and over that, you know, stayed with me. But as far as teaching me or wanting me to learn the language, no, because they were very colonized. They were both boarding school products, and they were taught that, no, you don't use the language. And I remember my father saying to me, well, I want you to be successful in the white man's world. I want you to be able to be successful, and so there's no need for you to learn the language. Oh, how sad. And then in my dad's last few years, he apologized to me because he always saw me struggling to learn and asking him questions, and he said, I'm so sorry, because it would have been so easy. It would have been so easy for your mother and me to teach you the language. And I'm sorry, I apologize to you. And we just were quiet about it for a while.
Mm-hmm. What is your first memory of seeing Native art?
My first memory of seeing art was when I was a baby in a crib. Because I remember standing on my tippy toes, holding onto the top of a crib, and stretching to look up on the wall and see a German print. And it was of an angel, arms out like this, and two children crossing a rickety old bridge. And I, you know, it's such a clear, vivid memory of my seeing that image and not having the language, of course, but knowing that I wanted to be near it and stretching to see if I, but it was way up on the wall. So that's one of my biggest, you know, I'm an advocate for, please bring your art down on the wall for somebody in a wheelchair or babies to even look at, because art should be accessible.
That is an amazing story. How about your first memory of making art?
Well, my first memory of making art would be because I grew up alone and I was always outside. In fact, I like to say I grew up in a china berry tree because my parents were working all day, and I was home alone, and I would make breakfast, and then I would take it up in a sack and be up in the tree. But I remember spending a lot of time looking at the landscape, looking at the land, looking at bugs, looking at everything, and just really. So I saw oil after a rain. I saw oil from a car on the roads, and looking at the beautiful iridescent colors, and thinking, I wish I could save that. I wish I could save that. And then I remember seeing, later. It influenced a letter piece from the H2O exhibit, but I remember seeing the dried up mud that formed little images and designs, and I thought to myself, that's got to be chocolate. It looks like chocolate. If I believe it's chocolate, it's going to be chocolate. It wasn't chocolate. It was a mud pie. But I looked at everything like that. I was very interested in design and colors and the iridescence on bugs and everything. I was just very interested in the world. But I remember just drawing in the sand with a stick. I mean, that's probably my earliest memory of making something. And then every year at the Dutch Reformed Church then, they would give out a huge bag full of gifts. And I always looked for the art things, like the watercolors or the crayons or something like that. And one year, I had some finger paints. And I remember my thrill at being able to play in finger paints. And it's the first time I had something quite like that. So I just really enjoyed that.
So tactile.
Yes.
How about extended family in terms of you mentioned your mother was a seamstress that might have been artistic influences.
Well, she was very creative because she could always, she was a problem solver, and she would laugh at her position because she said, I never made a dress, I never, you know, sewed on a machine really before this job, and she said, but I had that title. But she could look at something and make something fit, and she could repair something. So she had very creative ways, and she knew measurements like, well, from my nose to my elbow is 1 yard or so. I don't know. She had measurements like that. I remember her talking about it. So she was very creative.
What kinds of art experiences did you have in elementary school and middle school?
I lived for art in school, my early experiences, and that's why I was in school, was the little bit of time that we spent in art. I remember living for those times. And then I was in the third grade, and I had a teacher named Miss Moss, and I wasn't really an achiever then. I remember Miss Moss, we had a little assignment, and it had to do with numbers, and that we draw 3 fire trucks, draw, you know, this, and, well, kids are more sophisticated these days, but that little assignment, I remember drawing and taking my time and care and excited about it. And I remember her saying, Juanita Pataponi, come with me up to the front of the room. And I thought, oh no, what did I do? I was so afraid. I remember a heart beating fast. But she brought me to the top, to the front of the room, and she said, now show everybody your paper. I want them to look at your work. And then she had me go, oh my gosh, up and down every aisle to show everybody. I was so proud. So it was the first time I remember that first experience of success. Because I remember being in the second grade, and I had a reading teacher, and I was in a slow reading group when really I could read very well. I knew every word. But because I was in the Red Bird reading group, and it was all Indians, by the way, everybody... it was like that. And I remember doing that too, but I didn't have to do it, but everybody else did, so I did it too, although I could read very well.
It's great to have that support in school a little bit.
Yes.
And your parents too, were they supportive of your artwork?
They were. They enjoyed seeing my art.
How about junior high or high school? What standout memories of art do you have?
Well, I remember being very frightened to go to junior high because I heard people got into fights there, and I was just really afraid. But I don't really have any outstanding memories other than I had forgotten to learn the... you might have to erase this part. Let's see, what was it? Fourscore, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, 4 score and 7 years ago. I remember I had a teacher that was really frightened to me, and her name was Mrs. Grundy. Can you imagine having a name like Mrs. Grundy? Well, anyway, she said, well, everybody, you were supposed to have learned this, so we're going to go up and down the row, and you say it. Do you know I learned it? I was so frightened of her that by the time it got to me, thank God I was toward the end, that I learned the whole thing.
And you had it.
Yeah, I still
memory.
Know it. I still know it today, but that's when it, you know, so I don't really have any outstanding memories of. Mm-hmm. I must have been asleep through junior high, and in high school I remember taking art and getting to know other people that were taking art too, and you know, I was intrigued by some of the things. I still didn't really relate to it so much, but I did enjoy art.
You got some painting?
Yes,
kind of
I learned. Yes, a little bit of it. Very basic.
Right. What happened after high school then?
I went to Cameron, and I was not sure what I wanted to do. I must have changed my major 100 times. but I think I began to realize that art classes really, there was so much more to them. Printmaking and figure drawing, painting. There was a lot more to art than I had seen before, and I just began to come alive at that time.
What media drew you the most?
I loved painting. And see, I had always, because in high school you use, you know, the little watercolors, praying oval eight, right? Praying oval eight with a one size little brush. I did everything with that one little brush. Everything. And I didn't know about having other size brushes, fine brushes, and brushes that were sable or, you know, other materials. I didn't know about all that. And so I think that's why I say I came alive, because there was so much more materials to explore, and it was just so exciting.
And were you thinking at the time that you wanted to be a professional artist? How did you...
I wasn't sure how I could make a living at being an artist. But I just took the classes and enjoyed them, and then I thought, well, maybe I could teach art. So I began going in that direction, and that really wasn't fully me at that time. So I remember just... I was in education and I was in art, and I loved art, but I had some experiences too in art, early experiences, that I wasn't sure that that's really what I wanted to do. But then I had an instructor that taught mixed media way back, and I remember just loving, and I guess one of the things I remember is that I remember tearing up paper and standing on a chair and dropping those torn papers onto the canvas and then gluing them there where they fell, and then that would be the beginning of a collage. And I remember thinking, this is it. That was so thrilling to be able to, and creative to be able to start art.
And then it was sort of a newer thing.
Yes, and to be able to create composition with color. So that was pretty exciting.
I think I read that you went to... you just went to Cameron, is that right?
I went to Cameron for 2 years, and then I went to Southwestern, okay. Oklahoma State University. And I... that's where I began to learn a lot more about art. I felt like the different... I learned about mixed media, and it was very exciting to me. So then I was home for 12 years. I married, and then I was pretty much at home taking some distance courses. And then I was asked to come and teach art in Tallahena, Oklahoma, and I remember just enjoying that. You know, it was a half day class, but I enjoyed teaching art, and it was pretty exciting.
Completely different landscape.
And then I began to have my family, and every so often I would do art, but not really fully in participating here and there, once in a while in an art show. And I remember when I did art, I had a lot of compliments or awards or ribbons, and they said, oh my gosh, this is so good. Because I remember somebody putting up a pumpkin still life, and I remember doing my still life from the bottom up, doing a still life, the bottom of the pumpkin, and everybody was, oh my, that's so unusual. And I just thought it was boring to do a pumpkin, you know, still life, so I wanted to do it in a different way. So then I had little experiences like that for me were unusual and creative, and I knew I wanted to do more art, so...
So being able to shift from these small little booth shows, and then you have this, you know, period where you're raising your family.
Yes.
And then you start becoming invited to some museum shows. What was one of the most significant early museum shows that you did?
I think having some shows at the Museum of the Great Plains and being in group shows and exhibiting with the Comanche artists. And there was a group called Comanche Gallery of Art, and it was made up of people like George Smith Wachetaker, Wakia Bradley, William Pulfabidi, Leonard Riddles. And so some of them really became my early mentors in Indian art. So I saw their art, and while I never really copied their style, I saw them as real artists. I saw them as people that knew the history, and they were documenting the history and a very important historical place in life. Not even just as an artist, but another dimension to it, documenting the history. And so I really admired them, and they were my mentors. I saw their colors they put together and the style that they had. Each one had a unique style. So I really, I'm so thankful that I had that experience.
So when you did show with the Museum of the Great Plains, and it might have been a later show, you did a piece that was sort of a Only Daughter's Dress. I don't know if
yes,
that was,
a pretty, that was much later. Way after my mentors had passed on, but I did remember a story, and it stayed with me. And I had a friend named Charlotte Duclos, and she was a poet, and she always, you know, I told her one time, what makes a good poem? And she said, it has, she thought about it for a while, she said, well, it has to have memory, and then sometimes it has a punch, you know, that takes you in a different direction. And I've always thought about that, because I think that art is the same way. It has to have memory. And if you see an art piece and it stays with you, you think about it, then it has memory. Or if it has an unexpected, something unexpected about it, that not predictable, but something that you don't expect, then that has a punch, just like poetry. So there was a connection there, because I did both. And so I think art for me is the same as poetry, that it, you know, has to be memorable. And then one of those memories was for a Comanche elder named Ray Nido told me a story, and it was about he complimented me on my Comanche dress wear when I danced at powwows, and he said, Nita, I really like the way you dress. You dress in, you know, not the shiny, not the, but in the little more traditional way, because he had, you know, people were starting to wear shiny materials, and he didn't like it. And so he was letting me know that he appreciated my, a little bit more what he knew as Comanche traditional dress. And so I was just thrilled that he was talking to me. So I listened to his story, and I said, well, you know, wanted to continue to engage him in a conversation. And so I said, well, you know, there's one dress I always wanted to, I want to get his opinion on it. There's one dress that I always wanted to wear. It was a black velvet with cowrie shells. And he said, most of our people no longer know this. He said, but that was an only daughter's dress. The only daughter could wear that. And you're one of the people that could wear that, he said to me. So so decades later, I had that memory. And I decided to do an art piece. And I wanted to do it in a more abstract way. So our dresses are like tea dresses. In fact, some people say tea dresses. Very simple, shaped like a tea, but with the elbow to the under the arm is open on both sides. So I did the, you know, designed it, and did the black velvet dress and the cowrie shells. So
and made it very three-dimensional.
Yes,
with
very
the way it was
three-dimensional.
Framed.
Yes, and I just you know, it's one of the pieces that I think is a very strong, memorable piece.
We're going to look at it later. And also, there's a funny story about the purchase of that dress.
Yes, I had just finished it, and, you know, as everything's drying and the glue, everything's being sewn together, I took it to the Museum of the Great Plains. And a lot of times I've done this with shows, is my paint is still drying and I'm with a hair dryer trying to get everything dry just before the show, but to make the show. But I had just finished the last pieces of that, getting it together, brought it to the show, and the Museum of the Great Plains registrar saw it and bought it. It wasn't even, you know, the show wasn't even open, but he wanted to buy it and talk to me about it. So, you know, I thought, oh, I didn't even get a chance to enjoy it, or, you know, it came from a story from Comanche Elder, and I didn't anticipate selling it right away or even at all. So I asked him if it would be okay if I could make that again for my, yeah, sure, he was fine with that. So I did it for myself, really.
And that's how we get to look at it.
Yes, that's how we can film it.
What do you think was that transition? Because, you know, you're influenced by these older painters, you're painting primarily, and then, you know, gradually you're sort of working your way towards more mixed media pieces.
I believe I in teaching art, I was able to come across more sculptural pieces that I really enjoyed. I always loved Henry Moore's work. It's the simplicity of it, the images are just beautiful. So I had admired work like Liechtenstein, some of the mobiles, and enjoyed that for the color. And so I began looking at those art, studying about them and reading about them, and even once in a while being able to see a show, because I did get to see a Liechtenstein show. I'm very
cool.
Thrilled about that.
Where
but it was in New York. So I think looking at that and thinking about it, and then I took a course with Benson Warren, who was a sculptor, well-known sculptor at Cameron University. I took a course later, but I didn't quite have it all together. I remember almost being a failure in that class, not being able to come up with what he expected to see out of me. And I remember having a very difficult time. I'm not sure if he was just testing me or what, but I really had a difficult time surviving in that class. And once I remember submitting 32 designs before he finally approved one, and it was like, finally! But even though I wasn't terribly successful in that class, it was memorable to me, and it stayed with me. I couldn't forget it. I went over the things we learned, and it stayed with me, and I stayed with it until I finally got the concept of it. It wasn't so hard after all. It was just me resisting it and making, I'm not sure what the holdup was, but there was some hurdle that I had to get over before I could finally let go. You know, don't worry about the being competitive, and simply do what you can do and what you want to depict. And I don't know if that's it or not, but for some reason or another, I began to do some pieces that were more mixed media. I loved collage, and that was mixed media. So that was, you know, still flat. But then I began to, I believe what happened to me was that I had jobs in my career teaching, and teaching at the college level, that really took a lot of my time and energy. And I did not have the time to paint. And so, but I did have time to think about the art and conceptually how things fit together. And also putting that together with my early training with my mentors on the history, documentary history. and our stories, our wonderful stories. Putting those together and in my head, incubating, until I had an idea and I could execute it in an evening, a conceptual piece. And one of them was Eva Williams and I are friends. She's another artist, really respect her work. She and I both had the same opportunity through Cameron to put a show together, to curate a show, because they couldn't think of anything to do, and they wondered if we might put together a show. Well, I thought they'd only contacted me, but somehow or another she got more information and knew that we were both contacted. She said, let's collaborate, let's do a show together. So we met here and talked about, you know, what are you thinking? She said, I want to do a show with Indian women. I've always wanted to do that. And I said, that sounds neat. So then she said, what are you thinking? What do you think? I said, the first thing I'm thinking is, here I go, I can't think of her name, Judy, the one who did the table, you know, the...
Oh, yes, she's an artist and feminist, yeah.
I just remembered it was Judy Chicago, and she did a piece, it was a ceramic piece, and it was a triangle table, and it had very famous women like Cleopatra, you know, other important women in history. So, you know, I identified with that. So documenting history. And Indira Gandhi, she had amazing, amazing women throughout history that were invited to this dinner party. And she had ceramic dinnerware and place setting for each of them in a triangle. And the whole bottom on the floor was little separate tiles that I think there were 500 of other women. Women scientists, women inventors, women artists, women political leaders. So it was actually a very wonderful tribute to women throughout history, although we're not really in books. So I told her I was thinking about that. Could we do something that was similar? And she said, sure, that's a good idea. And Annette Arkakita, who was with us at the time, she said, well, what about, she said, did you know if we're going to have this table that that we have Joy Harjo, who wrote a very important poem about everything takes place at the table. Our children, our weddings are planned there, our deaths are planned there. We eat together, we celebrate together. Everything happens at the table. Children hide under the table. So we have a lot of stories about the table. So we decided, well, to contact her and ask if we could use her poem for the theme. And then we talked about, well, let's not have a design that's a triangle. That doesn't seem to fit us so much. But a circle would. But we didn't want to have the same round circle, boring circle. But we decided to do individual tables that would fit together at the top. And each person had, we would do an odd number because we thought, well, somebody's always missing at the table. Somebody passes on, somebody has other appointments. For some reason, not everybody can be at the table. There's always somebody forgotten. So an odd number would recognize that missing person. So we came together with this very powerful show, I believe, but it seemed I wanted more from the show. I think I wanted the show to continue
to
on
travel.
And travel, and we talked about that, but it didn't happen. But we did have 11 artists that submitted a work. We thought about people that we wanted to invite to this very special.
That's wonderful. What year was that?
What year? Good grief. It's in here. It's in here. Our place at the table, November 2007.
2007.
Yes, it was a collaborative project of 11 American Indian women exploring the impact of statehood on their personal histories.
Oh, it's the statehood, yeah.
Yes.
You also participated in the H2O water show, and I loved when I found out about that show, and you know, that's when water rights were really,
yes,
you know, in the media as an issue between the tribes and the state. And what was your piece for the show?
I had a piece that had a Comanche name, and the translation was, "Our land is dry." And it had to do with that early memory of looking at the dried up land and seeing the geometric pieces. And I had this sandstone that I had for a period of time, and because I'm a found artist now, I know that, I step up and claim that for myself, is that I'm always collecting things. I collect things on roads. People are looking at, when they travel, are looking ahead and looking around. I'm looking down because I'm looking for something that I can use in my art. And so I had this stone, and I decided to carve it into sections because some of it had already been done. And I decided to continue that design. And I looked at a lot of different examples of that to come up with one. The images that I liked. I sandblasted all these little areas out. And then I wanted to, because it had, the theme was water and the conservation of water, I wanted to incorporate my name into this piece. And it was Parapuni, is the Comanche pronunciation of Patapony, anglicized. Mm-hmm. So Parapuni, Pa means water. Mm-hmm. And Navuni, or Kavuni, Ikavuni, look at it, means see how deep the water is. And it comes from a historical little journey of my ancestor. But I wanted to incorporate my name into it because it has everything to do with water and see how deep the water is. So I decided, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how could I do my name into this piece. And I came up with a mirror, and it would be in the shape of a little pond. And it would, if the viewer looked at it and looked down into it, they would see reflection of themselves. And our people saw themselves for the first time in the reflection of water. Bah. Mm-hmm. So that was a good connection for me. So that was able to connect. And also some design, and I think about the land that you can find rusted things on the earth. And so I incorporated some modern design into it using some metal pieces that I found.
Yes, I thought I saw metal separating,
yes,
some of the cracks. And
yes.
It was a really powerful piece, even just from a photograph.
Thank you.
And because it was that particular combination that just, like, you know, you can get blasé about mixed media, but it was like kind of shocked you.
And it's exactly that. Our land is dry. We were in a drought. And we had been in a drought for a time. And it was really a big concern, especially when there are political issues like fracking that can use some of our purest water to create oil, and our addiction to oil and all of that.
Yeah.
But that was a concern. So, you know, looking at that piece in a lot of different directions, it came together all at once. So I'd spent a lot of time thinking about it, and then boom, I knew what I wanted to do. Came together quickly, except for the, you know, sandblasting the little sections.
Right.
Took some time.
You've been honored by Comanche Nation College with a Dean Emeritus title. When did that happen, and how did that impact you?
I didn't know I had that Dean Emeritus title.
I read it online, so maybe.
Oh my. Well,
might not be accurate, but well, you taught.
Yes.
You taught there. So,
well,
talk about your teaching experience.
I did a presentation in Texas at Tarrant County Community College, and it was on leadership. And one of the things I said to them was, I don't know if anybody ever sets out to be a leader. I'm not sure about that, but I never set out to be a leader. But I am somebody who's willing to help. And oftentimes I found myself in leadership positions simply because I said, I'll help. I found myself as a tribal administrator by being willing to help. I found myself as a dean of academic affairs in the same way because I was faculty, but it was also about problem solving and making sure that everything was going in the right direction for the college and that we could be accredited one day and building and working on the infrastructure and teaching and all those wonderful things, working with Native students, pretty exciting. I'm so fortunate to have fallen into that, but I was asked to put in for that when it came up open, and I did, and oh boy, when I got the position, then there was really no time for anything else because it's a very responsible position. And I retired from that position in 2013. I was home for 6 months and asked to come back as the interim president, which I did for 7 months. So I'm very honored by those positions. They're very, to me, pinnacle of my whole career to be able to do a responsible, exciting, important job like that. But it also meant that I wasn't able to do art, but I could do a lot of thinking, incubating ideas, and I could put something together by thinking about it. And I've done that. So I still, you know, art is always has an important place, no matter what I'm doing. But I might not have a whole lot of time for it.
You received a cultural award from Lawton in 1995, I think, which I guess was as an artist award.
Yes, I think I was very active back then. I think I was doing a lot of art and having shows and being involved in the arts and humanities and serving on the museum boards, and I was very involved.
And actually, Lawton, I don't know if you've dealt with, I know they've got a couple of strong galleries, or at least
yes,
one.
The Leslie Powell Gallery.
The Leslie Powell Gallery.
And the Museum of the Great Plains, too, right. Has had a number of shows. But the Leslie Powell Gallery is really a nice gallery, and some people say, I didn't know this was in Lawton. It doesn't even seem like we're in Lawton. It was just so elegant and professional. And I've had a show there with Brent Greenwood.
I see. Mm-hmm. When was that?
And then I had, I'll have to look at that.
4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And then that's when I walked into that show, I remember the first thing I saw was this painting of Brent Greenwood's, and I remember, wow, it had memory. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I thought about it, but Brent liked a teepee that I had done, and he came up to me, and I was thinking about the same thing, but he came up to me and said, would you be interested in trading art for art? And I, oh my gosh, yes, and I knew exactly the one I wanted, and he made a comment about, well, we're trading art for art, we're trading teepees for teepees. So this is a teepee that I traded with him.
And was it a mixed media piece?
It was a a painting on a hide that was shaped like a teepee cover, and it had an unusual shape, and it was sponsored by the Arts Council of Oklahoma. And Carol Whitney put the grant together for that show and invited a number of artists. And there were some really powerful artists in that show. And I remember we had months, almost a year to complete this piece. And I remember looking at the list of artists, people that were just amazing, and I thought, how can I compete with those people? And so I spent months just not doing anything. And then toward the end, the last few months, and I thought, I've got to get busy on this. And then when I thought, well, it had, you know, one should do something that was Comanche. And so I thought, I've got to do some documentation. I've got to go to the museum and study and read. And then when I got over myself, I thought, I'm Comanche for Pete's sakes. I should be able to come up with something Comanche. So I completed in a very short time.
You had a solo show at the American Indian Community House, I read, a few years ago.
Yes, it was a show with Shan Gosorn, and also Annette Arkakita had a very important ghost dance, a play that she had written that was very important. And so I did some art that went along with the theme of NAGPRA. And I have one piece here that I can show you that it, I felt was very connected to that show, and it had to do with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act in 1990, and it was a borrowed piece. I borrowed a story from the Cheyenne people, and it was about a young woman. I took that story. And so that was part of the repatriation for me. It was symbolic of the repatriation, is that I, a Comanche, used a Cheyenne story to depict the story of the first trade between the humans and a pack rat.
Oh, yeah.
So that was my piece in that show, one of the pieces. But that was, it ended up being a very major thing because it had to be in a storage. It had to be in a frozen, you know, for any bugs that in the gallery. That
because
it had
of
some
that
big yes
material.
Because of the wood and the hole in the wood and infestation, and it led to a lot of. And so finally, the what we did was for the opening, I could show it, but I couldn't show it for the rest of the exhibit.
Oh my
so
goodness.
So it was in that, but that was my most important piece of the show. But it could only be in the opening.
I actually know that story, too.
Yes, yes.
So who ended up with that piece?
I have it here,
although I
gave it to Ava Hamilton because she is Cheyenne. And I said, I feel like it should belong to some Cheyenne person. And I said, I'm going to give it to you. But she's never been able to travel with it since she lives in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. So, no, she lives in Colorado. Yeah.
Well, you know, and hearing the stories are such a connective thread story between your different works. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the buffalo hide piece that you did for the Museum of the Great Plains.
The buffalo hide piece that I did for the I didn't do it for the Museum of the Great Plains. I did a buffalo hide. I had thought about this for a long time. I wanted to do a piece that would commemorate the Comanche history. From my own perspective, and also the perspective of the Comanche people themselves, children, elders, middle-aged people, people that knew a lot about the history and were connected, and people who weren't so connected. I wanted to put a story together that would be contemporary, and it would give a little bit about our history from leaving the Shoshone Nation way back in the 16, 1700s, coming down the Great Plains, traveling all the way into Mexico, the killing of the horses in Texas, our recent Texas history, on up to modern times when our tribal economies turned toward gaming, bingo, and other sustainable economies for the nation. So it was really a story about our success in modern times. So I had images like that then. And so I asked people, what do you think should be on this? Oh, you must do this, or you must include this. And I so those stories I included. So it came from the people, and I ask people, please pray for me to come together to be able to do this in a good way. Say a prayer for me, please, that I can do a good job, because what a responsibility. I took this on, but then it felt like a very rich but very responsible thing to do, to depict our history.
Definitely.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to switch and talk about your sort of a little bit more technical practices kind of philosophies. You've kind of explained how neat it is that you can spend your time thinking basically
yes.
about the mixed media pieces. So I'm wondering how much time you spend, I think of the concept, then I find the materials, or is it sometimes the reverse?
Well, when I travel, when I'm anywhere at all, I'm looking down, and so I'm finding materials all the time. So I have a lot of materials that I have collected that are waiting for me to use them. I'm always looking for materials wherever I go. And so I have a collection of things that are waiting for me to. So I know about those things, and I keep them in my mind that I have a number of things, like I'll find bottle caps that have been mashed by the traffic, and they look like little frames. So I find things like that, rusty pieces of metal and different materials. Recently I found a motor gasket on the way to Memphis, Texas, and we stopped to let our dog have a little break, and I was walking along and I found this perfect little rusted frame. And I asked my husband, "What is this?" And he said, "It's a motor gasket frame." Wow, it looks like a little antique frame. So I threw it in the back of the car, and I knew I would use it somewhere. And then when the Rewriting History show came about, then I knew that I wanted to have a formal portrait of my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, Ida Tomacara. And I wanted to depict her in history, so I used that motor gasket frame, and it, the piece was just so exquisite. The little frame was on both sides. I had this terrible struggle deciding, you know, which side. One was rusted beautifully and was green and had a lot of color to it, and then the other was flat, but it looked more like a frame. Which do I use? So it was so elegant, and it was so appropriate for my grandmother's portrait. It looked like an ancient frame, very tiny ancient frame. So I'd added some color to my a copy of my grandmother's portrait, and I used acetate to represent the glass. So I ended up putting it on Oklahoma sandstone and also the clay. And the connection of it was that the tiny shells that I added to the art piece, Riding Home, was the story of my grandmother. And you think about Riding Home, the Comanche people were horse culture. So that even the name Rewriting History is like you're actually riding a horse, maybe.
Right.
But also when you're a student in a boarding school, then they think about riding home. They think about being at home. So if I just had a horse to ride home, many of them thought, surely. Mm. So I thought about my grandmother and her educational story. And so that was a connection. And the shells had to do with or the beads that I added to the art piece had to do with her being a bead worker. And then the stone that it was on was Oklahoma, which the Oklahoma red earth. And then the clay, the ever-present clay. But then those two things also had a connection to the St. Augustine Castillo de San Marcos fort, which was stone and very, very cold and sterile to the prisoners who were housed there in a very foreign landscape. So those things, and that's what I'm talking about, the incubation, you know, mm-hmm. thinking about all these layers of meaning. So there's much more to it than just a rock mm-hmm. with some beads and a portrait of an Indian woman. There's a lot of layers of meaning, and that's the kind of art I like to do.
You've sort of talked a little bit about some of the kinds of research that you do. Is there anything we haven't touched on? A lot of it, talking to people, sometimes books, travel.
I'm very interested in the Comanche history and all of that, the language, the writings that are already in existence, and many of them are so stereotypical because they've been created in another time. And one of the goals that I have in my retirement is that I will be able to write the Comanche perspective to some of those same stories of adobe walls and the battles there and our perspective of, and I've been able to do that in some PowerPoints, but and also it has gotten into my art. So the depiction of all of that, it's all connected. And I believe that's what I've learned from my early mentors who were Comanche, is that, you know, I remember George Smith Watchetaker telling me, Nita, when you depict something, when you do something that's Comanche, make sure that you talk to the elders, make sure that, you know, do your research and make sure that it's correct. Mm-hmm. So I remember him saying that to me.
How do you sign your work?
Pataponi.
Okay, and we'll see it here
yes.
in a bit. What is your, when you are thinking about something, your creative process, are you keeping track in a notebook of ideas, or is it all?
I have a lot of different journals. I have a lot of different started art books and journals, and particularly when I'm incubating. And I really am a fan of the Wallace paradigm, which talks about preparation, that when you first get an idea for art, that you're doing everything to prepare for it. Sometimes these different terms overlap one another, but you're gathering everything you're thinking about. In my case, I'm thinking about it while I'm writing, doing research or writing or talking to people. That's a preparation for doing an art piece. And then the incubation period is that I spend more time in incubation. I spend more time thinking about it. How am I going to do it? And then my materials, think all of that. What am I going to need? The materials, the story, the documentation, but then also the illumination, and that's what aha, some people call it. I know how to do it. I know, you know, that's a short period for me. I know how I'm going to do it. Once I get it, then that's it. So it doesn't take long. So the verification for me is pretty exciting, because what is it then? Is it that you got into a show, you were accepted into a show, a juried show? Or was it that you sold it? Or was it that one person admired it? Any of those things, or verification is very different for different pieces. So, but that Wallace paradigm, those four stages, for me, in my later work, incubation is where I spend most of my time.
Just looking back over your career so far, what has been one of the low points?
Low points? Oh my gosh, decades ago when I had won, I think I won an award for one show, for one piece, and I can't really remember what it was, but it was a collage piece, and I entered it into a show at Philbrook. And I don't know what it was. I can't remember. I'll have to look back and see if I can jog my memory. But it was so long ago. And I remember I was so confident in that piece, but it didn't make the show.
It got rejected.
Yes. And I thought, how could it be? And I remember, you know, went through all these different stages. Denial, grief, you know, it can't be. And then I even thought, oh, well, maybe my work isn't that good. I remember it was a low point.
Right.
And I think that's what artists do. You get impacted by maybe even what one person says. But I've grown since then. That was so long ago. And critique was really an important class to be able to withstand what other people say about your work and make what they say constructive criticism of your work.
Right.
But I'm very hard-nosed now. I really seek constructive criticism. I seek the opinion of others. And what do you think? Oh, it's a little weak in this area. That's okay, you know, to be able to do that. And especially being able to teach that and see that in students, that it's okay that somebody, it might not even be right, but it's good to see that there are other perspectives. It's okay.
How about one of the high points in your career so far?
Oh my, I've had some really rich moments, but I remember one person saying to me when I got into the show in the Changing Hands show, one person said, Nita, do you think this is the highlight of your life? Oh, I was so disappointed. I hadn't even thought of that. And I said, well, I hope not. But it was a pretty big highlight to get into a show of that caliber.
It was. And I don't think we mentioned, you want to talk about who sponsored the show?
Yes, Changing Hands show was put together by Taubman and another individual. I have to look up the person's name.
And I think it was the New York School of Design, is that right?
It was in the Museum of Arts and Design.
Museum of Arts and Design, right.
And before then it had been the Arts and Crafts Museum, which, you know, does that sound very prestigious?
Right.
No. Sorry. But they changed their name to the Museum of Arts and Design, which really sounded powerful. And I remember getting an invitation to that show and being so, so thrilled. That's probably one of the highlights of my life, was to be invited to that. And then also being asked to, do you know Ron Anderson? Do you know how to reach him? Well, it's very hard to reach that person. But yes, he was a personal friend, and I knew exactly where he lived. But he was living off the grid for a while. But yes, and do you know where we could find Cynthia Clay? You know,
right,
that was
right.
Pretty thrilling to be right. Asked about people that I knew and that we worked together and critiqued each other's work, and we knew what we were doing.
Well, is there anything we've forgotten to cover before we look at your artwork?
I can't think of anything.
Okay. We'll pause for a minute and take a look at these pieces.
Okay, so this is, of course, the dress that you talked to us about. I don't know if you want to add a little bit to it. That is wonderful.
Yes, this is Tapunaveta Akwasu, which is a Comanche for the only daughter's dress. And it's a very special dress that could be worn. The story came to me from now-deceased elder Thomas Nido, who was a very rich historian, knew stories, and he knew our language. But he told me the story about that this dress could be worn by the only daughter. It was a special dress, and cowrie shells weren't in our environment, so it was a trade item. So it was very valuable at one time.
What a beautiful piece. How about this piece?
This is a portrait. It's a monochromatic painting of my great-grandmother, or in Comanche, Matsa, and her name was Wiyote Parker Tomakara on my maternal side. She was the daughter of Quanah Parker. She had blue-gray eyes, but as you can see, she was very, very Comanche. But the eyes came from the Cynthia Ann Parker captive history that we had. And I had a black and white photograph of her, and I remembered how the Comanche women were very protective of their hair, and she always had her hair in a very fine hairnet. It was braided, but this is how she dressed. And it brings back some rich memories of when I was a child, then I could see a lot of elders, Comanche women, dressed just like this. And we no longer see them dressed like this anymore. So I knew even at this time that it was a rich memory.
Oh, that's a great story. Well, thank you for sharing that, and thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, thank you.